It seems like David McCormick has done it all. He graduated from West Point and served his country as a paratrooper. He graduated from Princeton, then worked at a technology company and helped to sell it for hundreds of millions of dollars. He worked in the Bush White House and then became CEO of the world's largest hedge fund. In today's interview, we try to cover all that and his new book, Superpower in Peril. David believes that China represents an existential threat to the United States. He has a game plan that he outlines in the book for how the country can renew and restore itself, and we go through the major points of his plan. I found it a really interesting conversation, and I think that you will as well. Here is David McCormick. David, thanks for coming on the podcast, man. I'm excited to be talking to you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
First of all, I read the book, Superpower in Peril. It's a striking title. It's the type of title that immediately you have to have an opinion on it. You can't really be ambivalent about it.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of curious, like, just where the name of the book came from and why you went to the task of actually writing something like this.
Yeah.
You're a busy man.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I started to write the book several years ago, long before I decided to run for the Senate. And it was based on a belief that our country was in decline. It was really at risk. And that was ultimately the sentiment that led to running for the Senate too. But I thought across many dimensions, whether it's economic vitality and strength, the ability of people to have the American dream, our security as it relates to China, spiritually, how the country's values were under siege. All of those things made me think that the country is really at risk. And we can talk about all those things in some detail. But ultimately, I was optimistic about the future of America. And so the title captures what I truly believe is that America, our American dream is really at risk, but yet there's a path out. And I'm optimistic about our path for the future. So people ask me to put the book's so ominous, the title. But it's an optimistic book when you read it. And both those things are true.
And it is kind of a truth at the micro and the macro level. If your back's against the wall in some way, shape, or form, it's usually what actually calls out your best performance. You could argue in certain ways that the country's kind of gotten fat and happy over the last couple of decades on, you know, relative peace, relative economic prosperity, and taking their eye off the ball. Is that a kind of similar sentiment that you share? Would you?
Yeah, well, I think, the American tradition is that we get to the edge of the cliff and we pull ourselves back. Like, this has happened throughout American history, where whether it's the Civil War or whether it's really what happened in my lifetime, you know, you're much younger than I am, but in the late 70s, we had very high inflation. We were in the middle of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. We had spiritual malaise. 80% of the country thought that the country was headed in the wrong direction, 87% of the population. And that same thing is true today. 80% of Americans think the country's headed in the wrong direction. 60% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. 2/3 of Americans think that their kids are going to be less well off than they are. And so the good thing, if there's a good thing about those challenges and the fact that people feel them, people have different versions of what they think is going wrong, but most Americans think something is going wrong. And that, I hope, can be the catalyst for moving forward and making some of the dramatic changes that I think are required. And the book is meant to be micro and macro. You say it well. You know, it's meant to be specific enough where, you know, if I would, as a former CEO, I said, hey, if I was CEO of America, which of course it doesn't exist, but if I was CEO of America, what would I do to try to renew America? And that agenda is what I think needs to happen. And I believe is at least many parts of it are politically viable.
One of the things that you point out in there that, you know, you speak about me being younger. I don't remember the Cold War. I've had it kind of told to me by my parents. And at least the way they tell it, there's this kind of almost universal throughout the country acknowledgement that, you know, the Soviet Union was this, the USSR was this adversary of very real significance. We need to be stressed about it. What you say in the book is that, you know, the CCP and the kind of government of China represents an existential threat. At least from my perspective, I kind of feel like there's maybe not that same universal acknowledgement, at least of those stakes. There's people that say, yeah, it's a problem. Maybe there's technology theft. Maybe there's, you know, economic competition. But to go so far as to say existential threat, can you just maybe support that point a little bit and then we can break into what you think we need to do?
Yeah, and I think more, at least from a policymaker perspective, both parties, I think there's growing alignment that it is an existential threat. But you're right, it depends on what that means. If you think about what's happened over the last 30 years with China. And China, we America, brought China into the World Trade Organization, the WTO, with the belief that China was a developing economy, and that if we could help China grow and become part of the global economy and be integrated with the United States, if we could do that, then that would be great for China because people would come out of poverty. That'd be great for America because we'd have this huge market and we get access to it. And it'd be great for national security and geopolitics because our engagement would help China enter the world of superpowers in such a way that it wouldn't be a threat to America. That was the bet. And by the way, with a little luck, they may even become more democratic because as they were exposed to American ideals, that there would be embraced because it was hard, the theory went. It was hard to give them access to markets and everything else without people seeing that freedom, the freedom we have in America, was the core to a great society. That bet was fundamentally wrong. So we made a bet that went totally in the wrong direction. And that was bipartisan, by the way. And it's not proven to be true in any way. So it's true that China's economy has grown dramatically, but it's not been open. There's not been reciprocity. We've not gotten access to China's markets the way China's gotten access to our markets. But more concerning, we become dependent on China's economy for things like pharmaceuticals. In COVID, we all saw that our pharmaceutical supply chains are dependent on China. On semiconductors, where 90% of the semiconductors we need are manufactured by Taiwan, which is 90 miles from mainland China. So we have an economic imbalance, and the relationship's developed in a way that we become economically dependent on China for some of our most significant things. Rare metals is another area which are so critical to EV, electric vehicles, batteries, and so forth. But more than that, China, particularly under President Xi, has become a much more aggressive player on the world stage and has been much more provocative in terms of the actions. And early on in his tenure, he came into power in 2012, 2013, something along those lines. He said, we're going to make China a technology juggernaut. And what's happened is that China has taken the lead in many of these key technologies. And so there was a Wall Street Journal article, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago, that cited an Australian think tank that had done a study of these critical technologies, 44 critical technologies, satellites, artificial intelligence, quantum science, critical to America's economic well-being, but also critical to the national security of the United States. 37 of the 44, China was in the lead, according to this independent think tank. So that poses a real threat. Now here's the other thing that makes it more complicated. We have to be able to coexist with China. So it's an existential threat that we need to embrace that threat, put in forth a set of policies to make sure America remains in the lead and remains and maintains its global superpower status. But at the same time, recognize that China is a huge economy. It's got a huge set of capabilities, and we have to be able to manage our relationship with China, coexist with China in a way that doesn't threaten, you know, world destruction. And that has some similarities to the Cold War. It's very different in some ways, but there is similarity in that we have to figure out a way that we don't fall off the table and ultimately have some sort of military exchange, which is bad for the world.
From my purview, it doesn't seem like there's that same fear of some sort of direct conflict. Something like Taiwan could be a proxy, perhaps, in the way that, you know, different wars were proxies during the Cold War. But it really is much more of an economic argument, at least as I kind of hear it and understand it, because of that integration. There wasn't that integration with the USSR. They were like, you know.
Yes and no, in the following sense. I think what we've learned, what's different between then and now, is the global economy, then being the Cold War, and now being the conflict with China, is that we're much more economically dependent or interdependent than we've ever been with the world, not just China. And so what that means is that something like COVID, which when we could talk about COVID, emanated from Wuhan, I think with lots of evidence to suggest it was somehow connected to the Wuhan labs. I'm not suggesting there was an intentionality around that, but certainly there seems a likely connection. That is something that affects the entire global economy. It puts America at huge risk. So we are very dependent. That's the one thing. Interdependent, I should say. The second thing is the degree to which the capability of any major country to do existential damage on any other countries is greatly enhanced from what it was during the Cold War. So you think about the nuclear weapons capability, you think about biological weapons, you think the risk of those getting into the hands of terrorist people. So the world is in some ways even more dangerous than it was during the Cold War when, you know, they'd set up these red phones in Moscow and Washington where people could call to make sure there wasn't a misunderstanding. That risk of misunderstanding and dramatic consequences is greater now than ever. Let's take Ukraine as an example. The debate is whether the Russians or Putin at some point could use nuclear weapons. Who knows whether that's a possibility or not, but the potency and the effect on other countries is great. So I think that it's not crystallized in the way it was where, you know, when I was in grade school, we used to do drills.
Like duck and cover.
Duck and cover, what we would do in the event of a nuclear attack.
My mom's told me about that, like hiding under a desk or running home.
Exactly. So it's not front of mind. There's not bomb shelters in front of mind like it was then. But ironically, the risk, if there's a miscalculation, if something bad happens, is much more pronounced of the scale and scope of the weapons, and also because of the interdependence of the global economy.
One more question on China, then I want to talk about some of your action items for renewal here. You were previously the CEO of Bridgewater, one of the largest hedge funds on the planet, and their founder, Ray Dalio, is kind of famously of a position that he kind of sees, you know, China's ascendant, they're going to be the winner, and, you know, America's just on the decline. So given that you've worked closely with him, I assume there's some degree of a relationship still. Can you just talk about the nuances of how you and him see the situation differently? Because he's one of the kind of more public voices to one that I would say is somewhat counter to yours.
Well, the book is essentially my argument for the following. If you could have China's hand or America's hand in terms of navigating the future, whose hand would you want? And I won't speak for Ray, but I think many would read his books to suggest that he thinks China is well positioned to be the global leader. And I think fundamentally differently. I think that our system of capitalism, the dynamism of our economy, the quality of our leadership, the hierarchy of freedom, individual freedom and liberty as the driving force within our society, I think that gives America a unique advantage in terms of being able to maintain its position in the world as the global superpower. But I think it depends on what we do. And so what I'm laying out in this book is the what to do. In other words, we're at a fork in the road. And if we don't respond to the challenges that we face, we risk not being the global superpower. We risk being overtaken by others. But if we respond in a way that's consistent with our unique values, our unique capabilities, with an agenda of renewal, I think the future bodes well, and the future is more likely to be better for America and our leadership than the Chinese. That's based on the quality of our system, the demographics of China versus the United States, the dynamism of our economy. But again, it depends on what we do. And we can talk about what I think we should do, but that's the difference.
Well, one of the things that you lay out is kind of in regards to human capital and talent and how we cultivate that. And longtime listeners of this show will know that Hannah behind the camera here is a product of alternative education, you know, self-taught in all these different regards. It's something, you know, we really deeply believe in. School choice is kind of one of the things that you articulate there. Can you just expound on that a little bit and why that gets you excited?
Yeah, this is both a moment of deep pause and reflection on how we got ourselves in the position we're in, and then sort of an agenda for what we should do going forward. And so if you think about the building block of renewal, if you think about America's strength, its economic strength, its national security strength, its vitality, it's tied to individual freedom and the ability of quality of opportunity. That's a very fundamental difference between what I'm arguing and some of those. I'm not arguing for equality of outcomes. I'm arguing for a quality of opportunity. So we need to give every American the best opportunity to be the best person they can be, to have the greatest opportunity for the American dream, to be better off than their parents. And at the core of that is education. At the core of that is making sure that every kid, no matter where they start, has the opportunity to finish ahead of the race. And sadly, as I said before, that mobility to be born in the socioeconomic quartile or the third quartile and make it to the second or the first, we're losing that mobility. We're losing that capacity. And one of the key reasons is our education system. And today we're 27th in the world. Most kids graduate from high school without adequate math, science capabilities. And we have a case study that, despite you being younger, you remember really vividly because it's COVID. We had a case study of what happened during COVID where we have even a much more significant falling behind of our children across the country as a result of COVID. We have an experiment, a control group and another group. And the control group was private schools, independent schools, and public schools. And the difference in terms of outcomes and how they responded is dramatic. And so what I'm arguing from the book is the capacity for every kid to have a choice on the best educational opportunity to support them. And this is from a guy who's pro-teacher. Mom and dad were both teachers, so I am pro-teacher. The people that most influenced in my life were teachers, but we need to have a system that gives choice to our children. That'll create the competition. By the way, you saw these statistics. If you look at how education expenses per capita have grown for kids, they've grown dramatically. And then when you look where those dollars went, 70% of the incremental increase in dollars has gone to administrative expenses. So it's like running a business and seeing that every metric is going the wrong direction and not changing your business model. So what I argue for, first and foremost in the human capital area, is school choice and a way to make sure every kid has the maximum opportunity. It's going to be disruptive as hell. It should be. It needs to be. It can't be incremental. We need to adjust. And I'm heartened by what happened during COVID in the sense that we got mobilization of parents in a much different way. And we have new legislation in Arkansas and Florida and Tennessee that's really moving in the direction of school choice. That's first. Second thing is skills training. And I saw this on the campaign trail across Pennsylvania. We've got businesses everywhere that want to hire skilled workers, and we have a dearth of skilled workers. And part of the reason is that we drilled in your head from day one, the path to the American dream is a four-year degree where you learn about lots of things. I'm all for a high-quality education, four-year education, but it's not for everybody. And we need to embrace the fact that becoming a skilled electrician or a computer software programmer or a variety of other things that may not require a four-year degree is a central part of our society. It's a central building block of our society. And there's lots of programmatic ways that the government can do that. The VA benefits, veterans benefits, which I was the beneficiary of, the GI Bill. I used the GI Bill to go to graduate school. That was an incredible opportunity for me. We need to have that opportunity for veterans to have skilled training that would count to the third piece, which is a very controversial issue in of the human capital agenda, but very controversial in politics today, is immigration. And two things can be true at the same time. And this is the point I try to make in the book. We absolutely need to control our borders. We're losing our sovereignty as a result of it. The fentanyl crisis in the United States and Pennsylvania is a direct consequence of those open borders. I think the behavior of our public officials in terms of managing that has been abysmally bad. So we have to stop that. At the same time, we need to embrace legal immigration reform to make sure that the kinds of skilled, capable workers that want an opportunity at the American dream come in. The needs of our businesses and society are matched to where those immigrants can have the biggest impact. It doesn't come at the expense of American workers. These are, throughout history, having skilled immigrants in the right spots have created jobs, not taking away jobs. So those are the three pieces of the human capital agenda. And if you said there's one thing in the book you have to get right, that's the starting point.
It was resonant to me. I just want to touch on one thing. Hopefully this, you know, podcasts lend themselves to nuance and detail there. And to me, I heard someone summarize the immigration kind of like political football. It's like everyone like can rally around an extreme position, but the reality is it's actually this nuanced gray area in the middle that is what most people want when they actually kind of think it through and have the ability. But it's, you know, you can have fiery rhetoric on either side that, you know, stirs hearts and minds.
Yeah. And listen, you know, this will be, you know, I did this political run and learned a lot through it. But I think that my takeaway from this is that most Americans, certainly most Pennsylvanians, recognize these problems. They have an acute understanding of the problem, and they genuinely want people, leaders, political leaders, that are proposing real solutions along the lines of what you said, and doing so authentically. So if you can have a match of genuine problem solving and solutions connected with somebody who actually believes what they're saying, that should be a great match. Now, you know, that shouldn't be so hard to find, but in politics these days, it's pretty hard to find. And so that's what I was trying to do, at least in the campaign I ran.
Unfortunately, yes, increasingly rare. I want to talk just really quickly about the school voucher thing. I have two children under three, so this is a relatively, once again, new thing for me to be kind of understanding, but it does also feel like it's kind of having a moment where the basic idea that a parent is kind of empowered with whatever budget would be allocated to their child or children by the state for that education, that doesn't just go to the school you happen to live closest to. Right. It goes to the parents, and then that can be allocated towards, if it's that public school or a private school alternative, they're kind of empowered to be a buyer, much like how we see in our healthcare system. People aren't making any sort of economic choice. They're barely making an informed choice because of the opacity of billing. The opportunity to empower the parents as kind of buyers of the type of education that they want is a really powerful idea, and is almost, at least when I've kind of talked about this specific element with people, I see it as like a blind spot. Like, you didn't even kind of consider that could be an option or was a kind of way to approach the problem because of how long that's not necessarily been how things were done.
I mean, the voucher concept makes so much sense. Just think of it like it's like your kid has a backpack, they have a voucher, and you get to help, as a parent, to decide the needs of your kids. And listen, this is the thing you see with parents everywhere. I mean, I'm a parent of six daughters, so I've been through this many, many times. The best high school, the best college, the best elementary school, there are different needs. But the one thing, whether it's the most educated, sophisticated parent in the world or the least educated, most naive parent in the world, they all share that they want the best for their kids. And to empower them by saying, we're going to help you find the place that's best for your kid and subsidize that effort with a voucher, makes all the sense in the world. Now, the argument against that I find not compelling at all, but the argument against that is that ultimately, if you give people choice, it's going to gut the public school system because people are going to leave the public school system. They've got this huge overhead of cost. They'll implode on themselves. There certainly would be economic pressure if all of a sudden people have vouchers to go to their places. But the thing that's missed in that argument is the public school system in its current form is most disadvantageous to those who have the least opportunity, right? So it's minorities, it's people who are on the socioeconomic ladder where they have the least resilience, the least flexibility.
Because otherwise the people with means will move to the neighborhood.
Right, you're gonna move your kids to the place. So that's the thing that's lost on it. I mean, the economic disparity most disadvantages those people that we wanna present the most opportunity to, because the others are gonna find the opportunity. And that is why I literally don't understand the counter arguments against, I mean, I understand the whose ox is gored and the unions and so forth. I understand that dynamic. But what I don't understand is, if you're talking about opportunity for all, if that's your headline, if that's your North Star, it seems to me that two things to be true. One is, the best way to get opportunity for all is to empower all equally with vouchers. And the second thing is, can anyone make the case that our current system, where's the data? It's uniformly dispositive. It's uniformly shows that we're failing our kids, and by doing so, failing America.
To me, it's common sense, like a lot of the stuff in the book. You mentioned data here. Can you talk about the data kind of pillar here of your plan for renewal?
Yeah, well, the point is, I was trying to think like a CEO. So if you're going to fix the country, right, there's like hundreds of things you could do. So the key, like any CEO, is saying, but what are the three or four things that you have to do? If you don't do those things, then it makes everything else impossible. And the three pillars were ensuring human capital is a key priority along the lines of what we just talked about. The second was technology leadership, because as I described vis-a-vis China, we're in some ways losing the war on that. And we can talk about that if you like. And the third was data. And you know, there was an Economist article, 6 or 7 years ago, that said data is the new oil. And I talk about that in the book, and it's so much more than that. Data is omnipresent. Data is at the core of innovation. If you look at the COVID vaccines and how those came about so quickly, it was because of collaboration on data. If you look at the human genome and what's happening in terms of the mapping and being able to map diseases is all incredibly data intensive. And if you look at artificial intelligence and the capacity to generate the next critical technologies that are going to change the world, data is at the core of that. And yet, there's no discernible data strategy. There's no strategy for ensuring that your data and my data remain our data, right? We lose control of our data. You get the email that says, you know, you signed off on things so they can use your data for whatever. I mean, it should be alarming to us all that when we buy a pair of sneakers on the internet, that for the next 6 weeks, we get advertisements for all the different sneakers. So your data, you don't have control of your data. So data privacy is number one. Two is ensuring that we're able to take our data and aggregate it as a country in a way that protects privacy, but also gives us the most advantage of that. And that's what China is doing. That's one of the reasons China has an advantage in many areas of key technology is their top-down control of the data. I'm not arguing for anything like that. I'm arguing for the opposite. I'm arguing for control, personal control data, but we need to have a data strategy. And then finally, our data is compromised in a national security perspective by all the insidious behavior of the Chinese and others. And it's also being corrupted by social media. So if you think about our social media environment, it's by any objective measure, it's heavily biased left in these big social media platforms. And that has a flywheel effect where it's essentially shaping the perception of Americans about a number of different things. And part of the reason that the social media companies can do that is there's no liability associated with what happens on their social media platform. So a good example of this is the COVID Wuhan Labs thing I mentioned earlier, which is the moment that came out as a possibility 3 or 4 years ago, there was immediate, no, conspiracy theory, knock that down. And so that was viewed as a right-wing conspiracy. And then a couple years later, we have all our intelligence services. It becomes public that there were a number in our government, in the CIA, in the intelligence community, in the Department of Energy, that thought there was a high probability of a connection to the Wuhan Labs. I'm not arguing what the answer is. I'm arguing for a marketplace of ideas and data that ensures that, that as most people in America consume their news through social media, that we ensure that there is an objective marketplace of ideas. So there's a whole set of dimensions. The final thing is we cooperate with many allies around the world on key technologies. We cooperate on defense spending. We need to cooperate on data. So we need a data regime that ensures that we share the most sensitive data with our key allies in a way that pushes forward on innovation and other things.
So I want to ask some questions about the social media piece, because I wouldn't necessarily, I disagree with your premise, but I kind of have an adjacent perspective. When I think about the ability for Americans, or if just through the lens of national security and a media narrative taking hold and being elevated or being buoyed, the number one risk vector to me is not a lower risk vector are these domestic social media companies. To me, the ability for a foreign-owned company to have, I don't know if it's the first or second largest share of screen time for Americans, is a much greater vulnerability as it pertains to a bad narrative being elevated or pushed down in some way, shape, or form. I'm talking about TikTok.
Yeah.
And then maybe can we talk about that, and I'll bring my other.
Yeah, I know, I agree with you. I should have made that point. So if you think about just the simple matter of how much information goes to a potential foreign adversary by just having all that data. A good example that I refer to in the book is that the Chinese government had gotten access to Fitbit data of our soldiers in Afghanistan and could, by doing so, track who was doing what, where people were, how the formations were moving. And so having the data from TikTok is of huge consequence, both in terms of the information that you could glean from that, that we can't even imagine the kinds of insights. But beyond that, you know, social media, and this is where it becomes a very sensitive issue around individual freedom, but social media has a pervasive effect, TikTok in particular, on our children. So if you look at all the academic studies on the result of hours and hours of screen time on what it does to our kids, it's an interesting fact that there's heavy restrictions in China on the amount of screen time on TikTok children can have in the actual content, and it's completely unrestricted in the United States. So that's another vehicle by which you can influence our children, influence our country. And this is a tough one for me because I straddle, as you saw, probably saw throughout the book, between basic concepts of conservatism, individual freedom, minimal government involvement. So I don't want some government regulator telling me how to regulate my kids on social media, but I'm really worried about the implications of social media for our kids. So it's a balancing act.
So when I think about digital, I actually think that India is a country that is really doing a lot right. And so two elements there that I think are really interesting is they've made payment rails and other associated digital identities really easy for everyone to access. And they're in a substantially lower, you know, GDP per capita situation. So they basically made that as a public good that people could have access to. And then what they actually did, I can't remember if it's 29 or 49 of the Chinese apps, they just blocked. So what we actually know is that as a gateway point, you have the App Store for iOS and the Google Play Store for Android phones. And you go to two entities, you say, this is the new legal regime, we're done. And you know what replaced them in terms of the marketplace? A bunch of domestic Indian apps that had a similar capacity.
That kind of thinking is very much in line with what I'm saying.
I think that that's the type of thing that, you know, most...
I didn't know the India case well, but yeah.
Most Americans are not, that's not an area that they're paying attention to, but particularly, you know, being a student of the technology industry, that's one where it's like, okay, struggling to see the bad outcome here, struggling to see the pain that they're experiencing as a byproduct of that.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Coming towards the wrap of, end of our time, David, I have a little more time with you. And we're doing this in Pittsburgh. We've had a lot of Pittsburgh companies, founders on our show, including Glenn Meekham a couple years back, who founded Free Markets, is now on to forever.com. And what I learned through, you know, some research in preparation for this is that you guys were colleagues and you actually took over as CEO of Free Market CEO, Bridgewater CEO. Can you just talk a little bit about that point in time, you know, the dot-com bubble, living through it, it bursting, helping to kind of steward a company through all that, what you learned from that experience?
Yeah, it was an amazing time to be in Pittsburgh and an amazing time to be at Free Market. So I came to Pittsburgh in 1996. After having finished graduate school and was at McKinsey for a couple of years. And there was this, I was in the procurement. You know, we worked with big manufacturing firms in the area, the big three, a number of manufacturing firms around this part of the country. And I kept hearing about this little startup called Free Markets that was a couple McKinsey guys, Glenn most notably, and Sam Kinney. And you know, we were in the middle of the procurement process, and the procurement process was so ripe for innovation because it wasn't transparent, there wasn't good data, and the way procurements were made, which were a huge driver of profit and success in these businesses, was very idiosyncratic. And so what they had done was the notion of using technology to create price discovery and competitive bidding, but really that was only part of the secret. The whole part of the secret was putting the entire online tendering process, including the requirements, online. And so we worked with one of our clients to use Free Markets, and it was magical. It was like, you could tell this was like such a breakthrough in terms of thinking about the power of technology. And soon thereafter, Glenn primarily asked me to join. And I joined Free Markets. I was there for 6.5 years. I was president for a number of years and CEO. And it was part of, one part, not the whole thing, of an incredible renaissance that was happening in Pittsburgh with Carnegie Mellon and the whole startup scene. And there was a number of investment firms. And we grew to about 1,000 employees, many of them Pittsburghers. I think probably at 600 or so in Pittsburgh, many folks we hired directly out of Carnegie Mellon. And it was dynamic and it was fun. And the whole city was alive and excited about it. And it was crazily at the in the middle of the frenzy of the internet bubble. And so the company went public in 99. It was a crazy IPO, many billions of dollars. And then in 2002, the technology bubble burst. And so we lived through the up and the down. You know, we were profitable and we were successful.
It was a real business.
It was a real business, yeah. And so we had 1,000 employees. It was global, profitable. And as the tech bubble burst and the whole industry consolidated, I was the CEO at this point. We made the decision to sell to Ariba, which was part of a broader consolidation. And Ariba was eventually bought by SAP. So it was, you know, a big roll up. And I'd say a couple things about that. One was, for me, it was very important that free markets continue to be part in its acquired state, continue to be a huge part of Pittsburgh. So I actually negotiated as part of that deal that the majority of the jobs, 600 jobs or so, would stay in Pittsburgh. And in the end, that became an easy thing to implement because Pittsburgh was more cost effective. There was incredible quality here. So a lot of the Silicon Valley operations moved to Pittsburgh because it made a lot more sense. And I was the president of the acquired company. But the second thing, and this is where I think Pittsburgh has a very bright future, but it's a reality of technology, and you're in this business, so you know it. I remember one of our investors was Kleiner Perkins. Kleiner Perkins was the big venture capital firm at the time from the Silicon Valley. So we had a number of senior partners from Kleiner Perkins that were on our board. And I remember being invited to a CEO conference that Kleiner Perkins threw. And it was an annual event. And so I think free markets at the time was, you know, $150 million, profitable, 1,000 people. And I remember being introduced to these two guys at the conference, Sergey and Larry, about this company that they had Googled. I remember them sort of talking to them briefly about it and thinking to myself, I don't know. I don't know. We'll see. The jury's out. And of course, that became, you know, the most, but probably one of the, if not the most significant technology company in the last two decades. But it was incredible and dynamic, and I think reinforced a lot of what's existing in Pittsburgh today in terms of the dynamism of our tech industry.
Yeah, and what's really cool is, you know, from that company, you know, almost like microeconomic history, there's a number of talented individuals who've gone on to start other companies.
Diaspora. Like there's the free markets diaspora. Like I was just with somebody the other day and they're describing this company and that company have invested. No, it's, that's the way it works. This success, I'd say the success of a company like Free Markets sort of is in three dimensions. One is, you know, it's what it brings to the customers and the employees, traditional jobs and so forth. But then there's a whole nother set of benefits to the region that come with the restaurants and the suppliers and all the other businesses that are dependent on that. And then the third and perhaps the most important legacy is what you just described, which is that's a whole generation of successful business people that are entrepreneurs that go out and try to build the next thing. And that we're seeing that today.
Absolutely. Well, that had me fired up when I saw that. And then you mentioned it already. You have six daughters. I have two kids under three. And I'm just wondering if you have any dad advice for me generally.
You know, it's going to sound trite, but it's just, it goes like this. I just saw a picture today in our house of my kids when they were like 5'3", 1" and, you know, or 7'5", 3" and 1". And it just seems like yesterday. So cherish every minute of it because it's not for them so much as for you because it goes so quickly. And, you know, I think the wisdom that comes with time is that each one of them is totally different. So you have to help them find who they're going to be as opposed to you imagining what you think they should be. And we, you know, I've learned that over the years and hopefully still learning.
Yeah. And one of the other things that I just noticed as I was, you know, studying your trajectory, we've got graduation from West Point, working in the White House, CEO of a technology company, CEO of a financial services company, running for public office. You're like a millennial. The millennials are the ones that are supposedly job hopping from like thing to thing, right? So can you just talk about, I don't know if it's a confidence or a carefreeness or a thoughtfulness to be able to go seemingly in all these orthogonal directions. I know there's the Steve Jobs quote, you know, it all makes sense looking backwards, but to other folks that maybe don't, like, I'm not just going to be in this one industry or this one career my whole life. Like, what would you say to them?
You know, your sentiment was my father's sentiment until like 15 years ago. My dad would say, on the military, he would say, what? You could have had a pension. 15 more years, you could have had a pension, you know? So it did feel a lot like hopping around. For me, it never did. For me, it always felt very comfortable to make choices and take risk. And they didn't all work out. As you see in the book, I got fired. I was a CEO of Bridgewater, I got fired. Then I later became the CEO again. So it wasn't like it was a straight line of success. But the thing that I had, I think, on my side is how I defined what I wanted and how I defined success. And I didn't define it as being the CEO of anything. I defined it as like a life of adventure, a life of excitement, a life of challenge. And so if you think about your choices in terms of that, then it makes perfect sense to go from this to that because it's all consistent with that theme. And, you know, I have the benefit now of saying, well, it mostly worked out. So it you know, was the right thing to do. But I think it mostly did work out because of how I define success. And I define success as great adventure and excitement and not climbing a certain ladder.
Another similarity that you and I have is that when I was young with my girlfriend at the time, now wife, we did a trip around the world, kind of living out of a more or less a backpack, Thailand, Vietnam, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Japan, a bunch of other places. What do you think? I want to hear about the experience, but I'm really interested to the statistics about, you know, 10% of Americans even have a passport, less than that have been outside of the country. Do you see that as a part of, you know, renewal and kind of development and that adventure spirit in the same way where we just got out and, you know, whether it's internal, this very large country that we live in, or externally, like, what would the benefit be and how did it affect you?
Yeah, well, that was when I left the Army, I had almost a year. I left the kind of, I decided to leave the Army a little bit unexpectedly. It's a whole different story, but I really came to the conclusion that I wanted to have a different, you know, a different path. And the way the graduate school lined up, I had almost a year before. So I, as you said, I bought this around the world ticket and it was $5,000. As long as you went in the same direction, you could take as many flights as possible. So I had like $20,000 of combat pay because I'd been in Iraq and Saudi Arabia for about a year. And it was kind of a random walk. I didn't have an itinerary. I would just go from one place to the next. And then I went to graduate school at Princeton for 4 years. And the two have something in common, which is I think you know they have this thing in the military about run to the guns. And the idea of running and trying to insert yourself in places, in conversations where people don't agree with you, where they bring a radically different perspective, is the most illuminating thing you can have in your life, in my opinion. So there's a choice. You can spend your time being around people who mostly see the world exactly like you do, or you can spend your time with people who see the world differently than you are. And there's, you know, traveling abroad, you see that so differently. You see poverty, you see different systems of government, you see whole different perspectives. And it's so, you don't have to win the argument. You just want to expand your own thinking. And it was the same in graduate school for me where, you know, I was with people who had been in the Peace Corps or had, you know, had these completely different experiences, sometimes very different political views, different views on everything. And that experience, I think, hopefully, it certainly made me a better thinker, but I think it also hopefully made me a better person because even the people I disagree with most vehemently, short of like if they're, you know, short of total differences in values, I welcome it. I welcome the disagreement because, you know, that's part of finding the best path is to have conflicting views.
In a previous episode, we interviewed John Dick from the company Civic Science here locally. And one of the things that he talked about, I believe he came from rural PA. He now lives, you know, here in the city. And he kind of talks about how because of the polling that they do, you get these like comprehensive pictures of people of, oh, well, they had this type of education and they consume this type of media and they do different type of things and they have these different type of preferences. And what he said, and I've always tried to take this into conversations with people I disagree with, was like, if I watched the same TV shows that they did and read the same books and went to the same school, I'd probably think a lot more like them. And so hopefully that brings your kind of like armor down and just see the person for who they are.
Totally. And, you know, what I argue in the book in the last chapter is, you know, I try to take on this a point of polarization where we've got these dramatically different views and this heated set of disagreements about the future of the country. And, you know, we've had our ups and downs historically where that's been the case. But I think one of the things that makes our current moment most challenging is it's not the significance of differences. It's the lack of commonality around a certain experience or set of experiences. So it's okay if we have lots of disagreements, if we have some foundation that you and I can both agree on. It's when we have nothing we can agree on that we can't find a way through the other things we disagree on. And I'm really worried about that because I think that we don't have a common values and historical perspective. And so I make two points in the book. One is, I think how we teach history is a big part of that. Because if you don't believe you're living in an exceptional country with all its challenges and historical, you know, dark chapters, then you don't think that your responsibility is to continue to keep it great. And the second thing I point to is there's a lack of common experience, which I had in the military. And I make the point, you know, one of the greatest things about the military was, you know, I had a, you know, African-American kid in my platoon from Newark. I had a guy from rural Alabama. I had a kid from Boston who was from a, you know, well-to-do family who dropped out of college. I had a platoon sergeant from Puerto Rico who was 35 and it seemed like he was 1,000 years old. I was only 20, 22 at the time. And that whole experience brought us together. And I don't remember ever, I don't know what anybody's religion was. I don't know what their politics were. It didn't matter. We were all part of trying to serve our country well and serve each other well and be part of a team. I don't want to overstate it, but we don't have that today. In 1950, 80% of the members of Congress had served in the military. Today, it's 17%. And I'm not arguing for everybody serving in the military. I'm arguing for a commonality of experience, what it means to be an American that can help us be a foundation to build on.
Well, another statistic that scares me, I'm not going to cite the numbers correctly, but it was this huge jump over the last two decades in people that said, I could marry someone who had different political views than me. Like I a bunch of my parents' friends, there's, you know, husband and wife, they're certainly not exactly the same, yeah, but they have these other points of commonality, they get along. And now they're, you know, for a certain segment of the country, it's almost like a religious dogma.
So they won't marry somebody of different political views.
If you disagree with me, yeah, there's just zero chance whatsoever. Like I'm basically closed off. And I kind of see that as a proxy to all social relationships. Yeah. And to me, that's like, you know, inherently closed-minded. And if we're going to be open to developing new technologies, if we're going to be open to new policies, new approaches to education, it's not a good indicator.
None of the solutions are linear. So if you can't take this new set of data around the world and forecast forward what solutions are needed because you're anchored in some sort of rigid assumptions, I think it's going to be hard to get us where we need to go. I agree with that.
Absolutely. David, this has been fantastic.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you.
I really enjoyed talking with you. We have our standard two last questions that we ask every time. First of all, if people want to connect with you, check out the book and the stuff that you're up to, where can we direct them?
Yes, it's Dave McCormick, PA. is the social media handle. And the book is Superpower and Peril, which is davemccormickbook.com, the order of the book. Yeah.
We're going to link the book, the social media, all that stuff in the show notes for this episode. I strongly recommend it. This was a breeze to read through, so I enjoyed prepping for this conversation. And I want to wrap up with the way we standardly do on the podcast, which is a challenge to the audience, something that we can do in the next day, week, or month to make ourselves a little bit better, no matter where we are. I was wondering what you were thinking.
Well, it's sort of the theme of the book in the following sense. You know, the country's is only as good as we make it. It's only as good as we make it. And I think most Americans think it's not where it needs to be right now, whatever your political persuasion. And there's this great quote by William F. Buckley, who's a great conservative. He wrote a book called Gratitude. And it says, being an American is a great privilege to be born and to live in the greatest country in the world with all the opportunity it has to offer. But it's also a responsibility to do everything you can to take it that way. So for your listeners, I would say, embrace that responsibility. Whatever that means for you, whatever issue it is, voting, you know, getting out the vote, registering people to vote, whatever your political party or persuasion, the things that matter most to you, our country will only be what we make it. And don't get caught up in the belief it's a flywheel, where it'll just keep being the wonderful place that it is without participation. So whatever it is in the next couple of weeks, I would suggest do something in pursuit of the America that you want it to be.
Don't take it for granted.
Don't take it for granted.
David, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks. My pleasure.
We just went deep with David McCormick. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day. Thank you for listening to the end of my conversation with David McCormick. If you found it interesting, I think you'd also enjoy our conversation with Glenn Meekham. Glenn was the founder of Free Markets, the company that David helped to sell. And we talk not only about the crazy times of the dot-com bubble, but also his new company, Forever.com, and lessons that he's learned along the way. Check it out.